The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
Okay, guys, welcome. I'm going to be introducing our speaker today. We have John Mulford here. He is a director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at Regent University. He's had a lot of different positions over the years. He's got degrees from Brown and Cornell, and he is going to be speaking to us about finance and the role of finance and how do we look at that from God's perspective. So please welcome John Mulford.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. When Jimmy Kwok asked me to speak, his first title was Accounting and Finance from God's Perspective. And I said, well, I'd love to help you out, but I don't know anything about accounting. So he said, okay, how about finance? I said, okay, I'll talk about finance. And I don't know how many of you are pursuing a career in finance? Whoa, more than I thought. Okay, well, you'll get some good stuff out of this, I hope. But also, those of you who aren't, I'm going to pitch this for what everybody ought to know about finance and managing money in a business. This is managing money, not just your own money, but the money of a business. And the reason I say it's not just for people in the area of finance is that I'm going to be speaking from my own experience, having run a business school and then been the CFO and the chief investment officer for our endowment. But I came to it not from a training to be in the finance industry. I was trained as an economist and sort of migrated into those positions. So the other point is I'm going to be talking about a biblical perspective, and that's something that I've been very interested in over the last 25 years, because when I went to Regent University in 1982 as a founding faculty member, we were a brand new business school. So the people who came were really pioneers. They weren't coming to something with an established background. And they came because they wanted a biblical perspective on business. Unfortunately, even though I was a Christian and knew something about the Bible, all my training had been at secular universities, as you heard, Brown and Cornell. So I didn't really know all that much about what the Bible said about business. So I learned along with the students, and it was quite a challenge in the early years. So I hope that what I've learned over the years, I'll be able to share a little bit with you. But before I talk about managing money in business, I thought it'd be important to start out with a little bit with what the purpose of business is, even though Jeff Van Duzer pretty well gave my talk of the first part of this in the seminar on Thursday. So if you heard that, this will just be a quick, brief summary of it. Next slide. Purpose of business. Well, does everybody know who Milton Friedman is or was? He just recently passed away, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He said the only purpose of business is to make a profit. He said, if you try to do anything more as the operator of a business, particularly a public business where you're a manager that's of a business that has shareholders, you're stealing from the shareholders, because you should not be using their resources to do some kind of social responsibility of the business if that's not what they want you to do. Now, there was a big debate about this over the last 20, 30 years with another group saying, well, business really should be a good citizen. It has responsibilities. And it ought to be trying to solve some social problems. They based their argument in part on the fact that business, at least a corporation, has some special privileges. It's a limited liability. So you're only liable for the amount of money you put into it. Even if you do something wrong, cause a big problem, you can only lose the amount of money you put into the business. And it also has a perpetual life. It goes beyond the time of the people who are operating it right now. So their argument was business is well suited to solve social problems, and it ought to be used to do that. Well, even if you agree with Milton Friedman that as a manager of a business, you shouldn't be using its resources in ways that the shareholders don't want you to do it, as a shareholder, you'd be unwise to just tell managers to focus only on making profits and forget about any kind of social issues, because that really isn't the way God set up business. God developed or designed or made a way for business to have a much bigger role than simply a generator of profits. And so business really should glorify God. So let's see what a biblical perspective would be of how a business might do that. This is overlaps quite a bit with what Jeff talked about, so I'll go through it fairly quickly. But in terms of a biblical worldview of business, if you start with creation and what I call dominion stewardship, in Genesis 1:26 it says that God created man in his image and told man to be fruitful, multiply, and have dominion over the earth. So that is, God has given us a role to have charge over the earth, although we don't own it. We are stewards of it. Leviticus 25:23, God is speaking to Israel, and he said, don't sell the land. You're but aliens and tenants on my land. So it's not up to you to have total ownership. However, as stewards in the Bible, stewards had tremendous authority. It isn't something where you just do whatever you're told. You have a lot of authority to do something with the resources that the owner puts in your hands. And therefore, as a steward, you should be developing what the owner has put into your hands. Well, if God has put the earth into our hands and said, develop it, business is a key component of how to develop the earth. All of the building that goes on, all of the kinds of production and supplying of things is all done through business. So it plays a key role in God's plan. Second point is the whole area of self-fulfillment. If we are made in God's image, and God is a creative God, God is a relational God, having relationships with us, and he's a hard worker, well then we're the same thing. And we're not going to feel fulfilled unless we are actually doing something. If you just sit around all day, you're not going to feel fulfilled. The Bible talks about how you'll feel really good after you've had a hard day's work and you're sweating and you're tired and you're laying down, but you're feeling good because you've done something. Thirdly, businesses provide life-improving products and services, which are what the world needs. And so they're a vehicle to provide the daily needs of all the people in the earth. Fourthly, they give you an ability to provide for the needy. In Ephesians 4:28, it talks about stop stealing. Start doing something with your hands. Work hard. Why? So that you'll have something to share with those in need. So it also provides a way so that you can help people in need. And finally, business can be a part of God's redemptive plan. Now, if you go to a lot of mission conferences, you've probably seen the verse Habakkuk 2:14 before. Maybe not from a business perspective, though. Habakkuk 2:14 says, the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, if the earth is going to be filled, that means filled with people. Those people have a lot of needs. And as we saw, business is good at providing for needs. Clothing, shelter, transportation, medical services, all of those kinds of things, business is an integral part. If the earth is going to be filled with knowledge, business, again, is a great place to, as a great vehicle for that, because business is all about transactions. And in global business, those transactions and that knowledge can spread around the world very fast. Ah, but what about the knowledge of the glory of the Lord? Well, unless people like you get into business, that last part may not happen. Because people in business are spreading around a lot of knowledge, but it isn't always knowledge of the glory of the Lord, unless some of the Lord's believers get in there and spread that knowledge. And finally, if you look at Romans 8:19, it isn't just people who are going to be redeemed, but the physical earth itself is going to be redeemed. It says the earth is groaning under the ravages of the fall. And we as Christians running businesses should be concerned about that. We should be concerned about the earth and the environment. Unfortunately, I think because politics gets so involved, lots of times Christians just step away from the environmental issues because they get tied in with political issues that they don't agree with. And so we're kind of on the outside on an issue that we should be right in the center of in terms of taking care of the earth the way God wants it taken care of. Well, if you're going to have a business that operates according to that worldview, what would it do? What would the definition of a kingdom business be? I put down a simple one, a business designed to facilitate God's transformation of people and nations. That's a pretty big purpose. Remember, I think one of the speakers talked about, well, you've got to start somewhere and to work in the area right around you, but you can see yourself as part of this grand plan that God has for the earth. And so a business ought to be facilitating God's transformation of people and nations. Now, the attributes of a business that would do that would be the owner and the CEO has a kingdom perspective. Because how are you going to transform people and nations if you don't even know what you're trying to do? This is a problem with many Christians in business who are good people. They're operating businesses in an honest way, but they don't have a kingdom perspective. They don't really have a Christian worldview. So they're honest, and they're not cheating people, but they're not pursuing a kingdom perspective. They're not pursuing the worldview of transforming people and nations. Well, if the business has a kingdom purpose, that purpose should be to meet spiritual, social, and economic needs around the world. And every part of the organization, its structure, its policies, the procedures, should all contribute to that kingdom purpose, and all of the people that are touched by that business should be treated in a godly way. That, in a nutshell, is what a kingdom business would look like. Okay, well, let's see then, based on that, what we would say about profits. Because we're going to be talking about money, so profits are something that's going to come up in business. Well, I would say that profits are a byproduct of successful businesses. So, whereas Milton Friedman was talking about seeking profits, what happens when you seek things? Have you ever tried to get a grade? And so you seek after that grade, that's all you think about. I gotta have an A, I gotta have an A, I gotta have an A. But if you're not doing the studying, you're not doing the things you need to do in order to get an A, then you're not gonna get one. So if you look at people in business and all they care about is making profits, generally those people don't make profits. Because they're too focused on the end result, which is really a byproduct of doing all the right things that are gonna create the profits. Profits are one metric of business success. I could talk a lot about other bottom line issues, but since this talk is about finance, I'm not going to talk about those today. So if you don't have profit, if you have lack of profit, you have a sick company. It's kind of like taking your temperature. If you take your temperature and it's 100 degrees, you're probably going to lie down and rest. If you measure your business and it's got no profits, you better do something. There's a problem. You've got to make some adjustments. If you take your temperature and it's 105, you're probably going to go to the hospital, because you may die. And if you take the business's temperature and it's hemorrhaging profits, it has huge losses, it needs major surgery. And if you don't do something drastic, you're not going to have a business anymore. Now, all of that's fine to say that if you run a business by godly principles according to that Christian worldview of business, it ought to make profits. But that's not always going to be the case. Sometimes you're going to be running a business in a place that's very unfriendly to business. Think of it kind of like trying to run in the mud. You know, if you're running on a nice hard track, maybe you're a fast runner, you can run a 6-minute mile or a 5-minute mile, or somebody maybe even a 4-minute mile. But if you're running through foot deep mud, you're probably not going to run even a 10-minute mile. Well, the same thing might be true for business. If you operate the same business that's doing great here in the United States and you put it into Ukraine, which happens to rate number about 126 out of 160 in the ease of doing business in the world, you're going to have problems because you don't have good laws to protect your private property. You don't have good ownership laws. You don't have good laws to enforce contracts. The courts have many problems, including a lot of corruption. So tax system is amazingly bad in terms of taxing away all your profits. So it's very difficult to make money even with the same business. And yet, many of the countries where it's the most difficult to make profits are the ones where people who are interested in missions want to go. So I would say that just because a business isn't making huge profits isn't necessarily an indication that it's not successful at serving its needs. And we'll talk about that a little more later. In fact, I'll talk about that more tonight in another talk. Well, what about nonprofits? Because I know that many people at this conference are thinking about working in nonprofit organizations. Maybe it's a church or a parachurch ministry or a missions agency or something that's, quote, nonprofit. Well, the point is that financial principles, the principles of being a good steward of resources, are basically the same whether you're in a for-profit organization or a not-for-profit. And in fact, you can take many things and many types of activities and either create a for-profit organization to do them or a not-for-profit. And the most typical for-profit approach would be if the person who's going to consume your good or service wants it and can pay for it. Then you've got a basic the normal for-profit situation. But what happens if that person that wants the good or service that you've got can't afford to pay for it? You don't have a natural for-profit business opportunity, but it isn't necessarily a non-profit opportunity. Let's take healthcare. Let's say someone can't afford healthcare. Well, you could create a not-for-profit hospital, and when that person got sick, they could come there and get free service. Well, somebody's got to pay for that. It could either be the other people that are paying for service would pay a little bit extra and that would cover that, or it could be the local government, or it could be the federal government, other people paying to make up the difference. But you could also create a for-profit company to do the same type of thing. In fact, we've got one where I'm from, Virginia Beach, Virginia. There's a for-profit company whose primary customer is our poor children who can't afford health care. And they manage health care. It's called Amerigroup. Well, Amerigroup looks to their customer when the customer has no money. But the states have Medicaid programs that pay for this children to have health care. So what Amerigroup says to the state is, we can actually manage the health care of these children better than what you're doing in a way that we can make a profit and you'll pay less than you're currently paying. So now you have a for-profit company that's serving the needs of a customer that doesn't have any money. So it's not necessarily that for-profit companies only happen when you have customers that have a lot of money. In fact, you can look at universities. How many go to a non-profit university? Or have gone to one? How many go to a for-profit university? Okay, you got a mixture. So you could have a university that sets itself up and says, we're going to charge enough tuition that will pay for all our bills and we're going to make a profit. University of Phoenix has made a big profit doing this. They're the largest private university in the U.S. and have a market capitalization of several billion dollars. So the student, although, may not pay the full bill because an employer might pay it or the government might have a grant that pays, and yet still it's a for-profit company. Or it could be a university where you have all the same things happening. Students are paying some tuition. Government's giving some grants, but the university also accepts donations and ends up being a not-for-profit. Next slide. Well, let's turn now to money, since that's what I'm supposed to be talking about. Money or finance. And when I say money, an economist has various technical definitions of money, and there are different types of money, but I'm not going to worry about any of that. When I say money, I'm using it interchangeably with finance or financial resources. It's kind of a general concept. But if you think of money, it's a store of value and a medium of exchange. That is, it's if you hold some money, you can still buy something later on with it, and you can use it in order to buy and sell things. Now, if you own an apartment and I wanted to stay in it for a year, would you let me stay for free? How many would let me stay for free? There's one. We got one nice guy here, but the rest of you are going to charge me, right? I'm going to have to pay rent. Why is that? Because you've got something valuable. It's a resource. It's an apartment. And you say, if I want to use it, I have to pay for it. Money's the same thing. If you had $10,000, anybody have $10,000? Well, nobody wants to volunteer. But if you did, and I said, could I use it for next year? You'd say, well, you can rent it from me, and I need some interest. I need something back for it. I'm not just going to let you have it for nothing. So it's very similar in that sense to other assets. Now, money gets used to invest in business growth. We just had Christmas holidays at my house. In fact, I came here and left about a dozen people at my house because when we had set that up, I hadn't planned my time to come here. But one of them was my brother, and he has a business that's growing very fast. And he was telling me some of the issues that are coming up about how he needs finances in order to grow this business. Because think about it. You want to grow your business. So you hire some more salespeople. You get some more product that you're going to sell. And then you sell it. But what happens in business when you sell things? You don't always get paid right away. So now I've paid the person to sell it. I've paid the person to make it. I've paid somebody to get the stuff that I'm going to sell. But I haven't gotten paid yet. So he's got what's called receivables. He's got $500,000 increase in receivables. Well, if he's making profits, that's okay. Let's say he made exactly $500,000 in profits. That could cover that increased cost of receivables. He just wouldn't have any money to take home, any profits to take home with him. But he'd say, well, they're temporarily being used to cover these receivables. Unfortunately, the IRS doesn't see it that way. They say, well, those are profits, and you have to pay taxes. So not only does he have to cover the $500,000 increase in receivables, but he has to pay taxes. So he needs money. So that means he has to get finances from somewhere. Maybe borrow it, maybe get somebody to invest for this company to grow. Now, everybody knows about the parable of the talents, where the owner puts some talents or some financial resources in the hands of three different people. One of them goes and invests, does very well, gets 10 times. Another one invests, gets 5 times. Another one says, well, I'm going to bury it in the ground. Now, when the owner comes back, the one who buried it in the ground gets a big reprimand. because he didn't even have that idea of, hey, you can rent it. He said, why didn't you just at least put it in the bank and get interest? You know, rent it out. You just buried and wasted my resource. I'm taking it away from you. The other two, it doesn't say exactly what they invested in or how risky it was, but typically in business, if you're going to get a huge return, it's probably going to be a riskier investment than if you're going to get a smaller return. And so this shows, just in that one parable, quite a range from not even renting it out, sort of an extreme you wouldn't want to have, all the way up to a very high return. And that's what happens in an economy. So entrepreneurs, through innovation, are causing the growth of whole nations. And so entrepreneurs using finance to resource the growth are able to be the economic engine of economic growth in whole countries. Well, that's kind of the big picture, but now let's talk about what happens within a specific business. And because I didn't know who I was going to be talking to, I thought, well, let's get it down to pretty basic. So business basics, sell it for more than it costs you to make it, right? That's sort of the bottom line. So you can do that either by controlling the costs or increasing the revenues. Keep your costs down, increase your revenues, you're going to get some more profit. Well, in terms of controlling costs, things all start at the design phase. I don't know if you've ever been in the conversations that an architect has with engineers that are going to build a building, but architects love artistic flourishes. Engineers like simple things to build. And so if the architect says, here it is, and the engineer says, this is going to cost a fortune to build. I don't know if we can even make it stand up, but if we can, it's going to cost a lot of money. So there's cost. You know, in the design phase, you've built in a lot of costs. I'll give you one that's probably closer to home for you. We actually do this at our university, not to the extent that it happened though, to my son, who enrolled in a state university. His freshman year, I said, what are you taking? He said, there's nothing open. He said, every course I'm interested in is closed. It's full. He said, I'm stuck in all these courses I have no interest in. Because what had happened was the state said, you've got to control the budget, university. And so the university said, okay, we've got X number of students taking X number of credits each. That's how many courses we'll offer. Every course has to be full. They controlled the cost by just forcing people into courses they didn't want to take so that every course was full. That was a way to control costs. So how about in terms of sourcing? If you can buy the things you're going to use at a good price, you can keep your costs down. We have a company that's headquartered in Virginia Beach, where I'm from, called Dollar Tree. How many people have heard of Dollar Tree? Okay, quite a few of you. Everything in the store costs $1. Well, that means they basically said, we're holding our price constant, so they better control costs or they're not going to be able to make any money. In fact, I heard this guy, the CEO and founder, give a talk once, and people were kept asking questions, well, what about overtime? You know, how are you going to hold it to a dollar? Aren't you going to have to raise it to $1.10, $1.20? He said, no. He said, I've got ways to control my costs. Well, when he started out, he used to just buy up things that nobody wanted. That's how he controlled his costs. He got things cheap and sold them. But after a while, as he grew, he couldn't keep depending on that. So he went particularly to China, and he made deals with manufacturers in China. He would find things and say, this looks like it probably should be worth more than a dollar, but I can get it made for 10 cents. So I can have a good control on costs. I can get something people are going to want, and I'll be in good business. But some things, he has another way of controlling costs. Let's say it's a roll of wrapping paper. You just had Christmas. You probably wrapped up some gifts. Well, if costs go up, you just snip a little bit off the paper, and instead of 45 square feet, now you're going to get 40 for a dollar. Next year, 38. Next year, 36. So it's a way to control costs and still sell for a dollar. Production, another place to control costs. We certainly learned that in the auto industry by looking at what the Japanese were doing with lean production. You know, not having a lot of inventory sitting around, allowing the people on the assembly lines to be put their ideas in on how to do things better, and so you can control costs through production. Or even in marketing. You know, if you want to market your product, not everybody needs to have a Super Bowl commercial. They cost $1 million. You better have some good reason to spend $1 million to put it on the Super Bowl. Maybe there's some kind of viral marketing you can do. It doesn't cost you anything. So you can control costs in marketing. All of those things can keep your costs down. What about on the selling side? Well, if you have a product that's just like everybody else's product, called a commodity, then you don't have much control over price. In fact, you have no control over price. The market sets the price. Either you sell at that. If you try to raise your price, you sell zero. You can sell all you want as one company at the market price of a commodity. So you might not want to be a commodity. You say, well, I want to be in a different business then. I don't like being a commodity. So you differentiate your products in some way. You give it different features than the other products, you know, more on-off switches, more speeds, more whatever. Or you give it better quality, it lasts longer, it's built out of something nicer. Or you give it better service that's connected with it. I have a friend who, his company was on the Inc. 500 two times, and he sells commercial videotape from Sony. I once asked him, why don't people just buy it from Sony directly? And he said, well, they could, but Sony's a big company, and they don't really take that good care of these little TV stations that I sell to. And so what I do is I just keep in really close contact with them. I know what their needs are. I make sure they never run out. You know, I just make it up for it with service. And his company grew to be on the Inc. 500 twice just by giving a little service on the top of a commodity. Well, probably your biggest cost for most companies is going to be people. That's going to be the biggest cost, and so how are you going to control that? Or, as this conference would ask, you know, what would be a fair wage to pay? Because you don't want to just be the type of person that's just control, 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 and you don't care anything about the people in your business. Remember, we're trying to do this from a biblical perspective. Well, the market usually sets a minimum that you can pay. Of course, there is the government setting a minimum wage, but in most of the kinds of businesses and jobs you're probably going to look at, you hope you're not going to get stuck at the minimum wage. You're going to be at something above that. And therefore, if I'm running a company and I want to hire an engineer, and I look at some market survey and it says engineers make $52,000, I can, if I want to hire one for $20,000, how many do you think I'm going to get? Would you work for $20,000 if the market was $52,000? Okay, I get zero. So I've got to pay $52,000, but should I pay more? Well, I might want to pay more if I thought that I could get people who were much more productive than the people at $52,000. I might be willing to pay more than that. So that would be one good reason, an economic reason to pay more. In fact, I mentioned that my brother's company is growing very fast. He hires a lot of people who are, he's been hiring a lot of South Americans who were just working in, you know, laborer jobs in nurseries, or they're working in grocery stores. They're making $6, $7, $8, $9 an hour. They come to work for him installing. What he does is he installs alarm systems and home theaters and things like that in houses. And these guys who were making $9 an hour, because he's found people are very productive, working for him, they can make $60,000 to $100,000 a year. So he's finding people who are highly productive. Or you can find people who can produce something better. I mean, are all basketball players the same, or would you rather have Michael Jordan on your team? Maybe he's getting a little old now, but in his day, everybody would want him. Because he's not the same as everybody else. He provides something better. And the same thing happened with my brother when he found out he could hire, he hired a couple of Russian PhDs to install wiring in his houses because they didn't have any alternatives. They left Russia, they couldn't get good jobs there, and so they came to the United States. They were temporarily, couldn't find anything, and so my brother hired them. Well, he got a lot more than guys that were just running wire in his buildings. They were giving him all kinds of ideas about better ways of doing things, and they were worth a lot more than just the standard wage, and so he pays them more. But what about this third reason? Because the worker needs the money. You may have heard stories of people that would come, and they'd say, you know, I've got 5 children. My elderly parents live with me. I can't make it on $40,000 a year that your job is offering. Couldn't you pay me $80,000? Well, I suppose you could. But if the person isn't producing any more productivity, isn't producing any more better service, then what's going to happen if you pay him $80,000 when the job is worth $40,000? You might get away with it once, but once the word gets out, everybody's going to want that. Now you're paying $80,000 for everybody worth $40,000 and you're going out of business. You can't keep your business going that way. And so you have to have something to say to that person. What would you say to them? Well, you might say something like, let me help you find a job where it's worth $80,000 that you could do. You know, you might temporarily have to do this $40,000 job, but let's find something where you can make $80,000. Now, this is a difficult area. I don't mean to make this sound very simple. because I'll give you an example of something that happened in my business school when I was the dean. One of the people that worked there had hepatitis C, and his liver was dying. He was going to die. So, unfortunately, the way our health plan worked, he was going to slip through the cracks, and there was going to be several months where he would have no health coverage, and he would have no ability to work because he was getting very sick. So I really didn't, you know, I felt bad for him because if he was out there with no health coverage, he's basically going to die. But I didn't feel that I had the authority to say, well, we'll just keep paying you since our, you know, our university wasn't set up that way. But what happened was the people that worked in our department said, we want to help Mike out. We'll do his job for him while he's home resting. And, you know, we're perfectly happy doing that, and so let's just do it, and we'll just keep him on the payroll. So we did that. Now, it worked out. He got a liver transplant from another person who worked with us, who volunteered part of his liver, and he's doing well now. But I don't know for sure that there weren't some people in the department who felt that that wasn't a good idea. They just didn't speak up because enough people did. But what if somebody complained and said, hey, what are they doing? You know, this guy isn't even working. We could have gotten in trouble. So it isn't just a clear, you know, this is the way to do it, and this, you know, and you can't do it this way. You've got to have some discernment. You've got to listen to the Lord. And I can't tell you a perfect formula for how much to pay and whether, you know, whether to keep someone on, whether to pay someone more than, quote, the market wage. That's something you'll have to figure out yourself. Next. However, what's happening in the United States, what's happening all over the world, are that jobs are being outsourced to countries where the pay is lower. So you could say, well, what's a fair wage? Let's look at this one example. How many have ever heard of Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts? A couple people. In 1995, this made big news, when there was a fire at their mill, it burned the mill down, and the owner of the mill, this Aaron Feuerstein, said, well, I'm not going to just let my workers be out there with nothing to do. I'm going to pay them their full pay while we're rebuilding and we're shut down. Well, wow. I mean, people thought, this guy's amazing. He got introduced, the President of the United States had him in to talk to him. He made all kinds of news articles. And he was a real star. He paid 4,000 workers while he was rebuilding. Now, that company makes Polartec, which is a insulation for sleeping bags and jackets and things like that. So it's a high-tech fiber. But even so, the pressure to move offshore was huge. But he said, no, my family's been in Lawrence, Mass. All this time. We're going to stay here. I'm just going to put more technology in this building than you can imagine. So he spent like three times as much to rebuild it as what it was worth when it burned down. And went into bankruptcy in 2001. He couldn't compete operating out of Lawrence. And so now he's got huge bills to pay. Creditors all over the place. He had to go into protection of bankruptcy. And the creditors wanted to work with him. He said, I've got to keep this here. You know, I've just got to stay in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Well, eventually he lost control and he left the company and a new CEO took over. They're now down to 1,000 people and the rest are in plants in Asia. I mean, they didn't move to Asia, but the rest of the jobs are in Asia. And the only reason there's some jobs in the United States is that when you sell to the U.S. military, they demand the production be in the United States. So they are able to keep some jobs in the United States. Well, the lesson is that as one company, you just can't buck the tide. You can't swim against the tide of what's happening globally in the markets. And so even though Aaron Feuerstein might have said, well, a fair wage to pay is $20 an hour to my people working in this plant, he can do that as long as he's got the money to spend. But once all his money is gone, other people aren't going to be willing to do that. And all these creditors said, no, we're not going to do that. So he was unable to swim against the tide, even though he was held up as a great guy for doing this in the beginning. He really didn't do these people any good because he didn't come up with a solution that was sustainable. Well, here's another kind of a solution called fair trade. If the issue is, now all these jobs are getting outsourced, so what is a fair wage? You go to another country where people are paid very low pay, and people start saying, well, that's not even a living wage for them in that country. What can you do as an individual company? Not a whole lot, because if you say, well, we're going to set up offshore operations, and we're going to pay 10 times that, you're going to be in the same situation as Aaron Feuerstein was. You're going to be bankrupt. But look at how the market can work with this issue of a novel issue of fair trade. The issue is that in the developing countries, farmers, artisans, they're only receiving a tiny fraction of the final sales price for their product. Who cares? Well, sometimes some consumers care. Some businesses in that industry may care. But unless they can somehow get together, they're unable to have their individual cares actually do anything. But let's look at the coffee industry. If you as a consumer say, well, I'm willing to pay a little bit more for a cup of coffee, and a company in the industry, Starbucks, says, this sounds like a good thing. I'll get behind it. Well, now you've got enough power that you can get somebody to set up a certification for fair trade and say, we'll go out and we'll certify we'll discuss what the criteria are, but we'll certify certain growers as fair trade growers and we'll set up a whole system of fair trade. Now, what's the result of this? Well, you can end up getting higher wages paid to that person that's producing things. Where do they come from? You know, where do those higher wages come from? Well, some of it comes from consumers saying, I'm willing to pay a little more. Some of it comes by squeezing a little bit out of the supply chain because those initial buyers were actually making more higher margins under the old system than they're going to make under the fair trade system. And so throughout the supply chain, you might have a little bit of a squeeze and consumers paying a little bit more. You can transfer a little bit to the people on the bottom that are going to get, quote, a fair wage. Okay, well, that's something to do with wages. What about prices? What is a fair price? Well, we said that if you sell a commodity, there's only one price. It's whatever the market clearing price is, and you don't get to pick any other price. But let's say you have differentiated products, and so you get some chance, some choice to choose. You can choose to sell at a higher price and sell less, or you can choose at a lower price and sell more. So is there really a true fair price? I had a student, when he graduated, he'd been working in an auto dealership, and he said, I want to buy an auto dealership. So he bought one that had been, the person who owned it was getting old, and he was kind of let it run down a little bit, and it had low sales. And he went in there, spruced it up, spent a lot of money on advertising, and boosted sales tremendously. And he was talking to me one time, and he said, John, you know, really, they're viable models. You can have a very small quantity model where you're only selling a few cars a month, but you're selling for enough and you're not spending a lot on advertising, you can make some money. Or you can take the approach, you know, advertise like crazy, sell a lot of cars, and sell them at a slightly lower price, and you can make money doing that. So it's not as though one is right and the other is wrong. You get to pick as a seller where you want to be in that matrix of price and quantity. Now, we'll talk in a minute about whether that's good for consumers. Consumers often complain if prices are high, don't they? I mean, they don't like high prices. And consumers are worried that someone's going to get control of something and charge them a higher price than they ought to, and that would be, quote, an unfair price. But you know what? Producers don't like low prices. How many times have you heard people complain about Walmart? Well, they're not complaining that the prices are too high, are they? It's producers, you know, other stores complaining that their prices are too low. They're driving us out of business. And I think it's interesting that happens. I look back 100 years to when John D. Rockefeller was setting up an oil industry. And people all complained about him. I mean, you just read in history, there were a lot of complaints about him. I'm not saying he was perfect. But one of the things that he did, his goal was very similar to Sam Walton's goal with Walmart. He said, I want to drive down the price of kerosene, the end product coming from oil. He did. He drove it down from like 85 cents a gallon to 5 cents a gallon over about a 10 or 20 year period by investing in technology, R&D, putting together the whole supply chain. He was vertically integrated. He did a lot of things that drove down the price. And yet people were criticizing him for being, quote, a robber baron. Well, who's criticizing him? A lot of the people that went out of business because they couldn't compete with him. He was so good at getting prices down. Now, he did a few things that weren't so nice to his competitors, too. But a lot of the complaints were just sort of sour grapes that, hey, I can't keep up with this guy. And the same kind of thing happens with Walmart. But let's look at what happens in a defined time space, like a disaster. Let's say you have a hurricane. And now there's no, you know, everything's shut down. There's a limited amount of gasoline, a limited amount of drinking water. Now, if I say, oh, you know, I'm the only gas station in town, my price just went to $1,000 a gallon. Do you think people would say, that's a fair price? No, they'd say, you're gouging. That's terrible. And so people have this sense of, you know, if you're taking advantage of a situation like a disaster to extract from me everything I have, that's not fair. And so in that sense, most people would agree that that wouldn't be a fair pricing situation. But let's look at, see if the Bible has anything to say about this. Biblical principle for both wages and prices essentially is don't abuse market power if you have it. In most cases, you're not going to have a lot of market power because you're a small seller, you're taking prices, you know, you're selling a commodity kind of thing. But to the extent that you build yourself up or just through happenstance, a hurricane came through and you have a lot of market power, don't abuse that. God would say, don't take advantage of that. A worker is worthy of his hire. Pay him a fair wage. Even if it's in your power to just extract everything from him and just pay him almost nothing, that's not what you should do. Same thing in terms of prices. And it's not just the seller. You remember in Proverbs it said something about, it's no good, and then the person runs away and he brags about what a great deal he got. You know, he bargained the price down and he bought it at a low price and then bragged about it. Well, the same thing can happen in terms of fair price for a buyer. I saw this happen when I was when I took over the endowment management for Regent University. We didn't have any advisor because our endowment came in one huge gift. And so I had to hire an advisor to advise us on investing in the endowment. I talked to a company that was new in the business, and they really wanted our account. And they said, we'll do a tremendous job for you. You'll be our number one customer. And I quickly noticed I could have bargained them down to basically nothing. I could have said, okay, you know, we'll give you the account. You do it for free just so you can say you have us as an account. But I realized, you know, if I did that, that would have put them on the spot. They would have had a hard time servicing our account, and it wouldn't have been a good relationship. So we came up with what was a very good price to us, plus tremendous service. And they got a good client, and so it was a very good relationship, a good both ways, that the price was fair to them and fair to us. So if you want to have a good relationship, either with a customer or with a vendor, you want to have a price that you both think is somewhat fair. If you don't, you may get away with it for a while, but there's going to come a time when they're the ones in the power and they're not going to want to deal with you anymore. So that's why you'll oftentimes see companies pay a lot more to vendors than you'd think they should, because they're paying for a relationship. They're paying for that vendor to be there when they need them in an emergency. Okay, well, we said that people were the most important resource, and people respond to more than just what the wage rate is. Sometimes benefits can be almost free. That is how you treat people. You can do some things if you run a company that don't cost you anything. I read a story about this CEO of a mini computer company years ago who was sitting in his office eating lunch. An engineer knocked on his door. He had an open door policy. He said, come on in. The engineer told him about what a great job he'd just done fixing some huge problem they had and making this next generation computer a reality. And so here's the CEO, and he's thinking, you know, I always like to give immediate praise and feedback. What am I going to give this guy? And he was eating his lunch, so he just reached in his lunch bag and said, here, have a banana. Well, a banana. The golden banana became the prize award of this whole company. If you got the Golden Banana Award, I mean, that meant that you had done something amazing. Well, how much did a banana cost? And they made it probably into a plastic banana after a while, just so it wouldn't rot. And, you know, it was almost a costless thing that had a huge effect on people. But most benefits cost some money. You know, health care, vacation, all kinds of other benefits that you have to pay for. And so, is it a good idea to have a lot of those? Increase your wages because of that. Increase your costs of people. Well, it's biblical to do that. Because if you think about it, people are created and loved by God. So they should have a lot of dignity and respect. Well, people feel respected if you take care of them and give them good benefits. We're the image bearers. So we're made to be creative workers. Well, if you give people the opportunity to be creative and you give them an environment to be creative, they're going to do more for you. And we're created to want to do something for others. And so if you make that part of what you do in your company, things will be better off. Well, let me just look at Next slide. Companies are realizing this. These aren't Christian companies. These are secular companies. Are realizing that it's financially viable to take care of your people. They realize they need creative, innovative people, and not just to get routine tasks done. So what they're doing is they're learning to attract, retain, and get productivity from people by treating them well, or by, quote, ministering to them. I'll just show you a couple of examples that came out of the best companies to work for, 100 best companies, I think it was a Fortune thing. Well, the first one, Genentech, was number one, because you're part of a noble, significant mission. You're on a cancer-fighting team. I mean, that's something that gets you up to go to work in the morning instead of being on a cancer-creating team. You know, can you imagine, hey, let's get up and cause some cancer today? You know, that's not something that's really going to excite people, but if you can get people to say, we're going to fight cancer, solve this problem, that's a noble vision to go to work for. Or W.L. Gore, maker of Gore-Tex, they were number five on the list. Empower people as partners or owners of your vision. Now, it doesn't work exactly like this, but they claim there are no bosses, there are no titles, there are no organization chart. You just go there and you do something cool. That's what they advertise. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but there's definitely a lot more empowerment going on there than other places. Or, this guy didn't make the list, but I put him in there anyway. Listen to the people and get to know their lives. The JetBlue CEO goes on the planes and cleans them weekly. He goes onto at least a couple planes and works alongside the cleaning crew to find out what's going on, to hear what they're saying, what their issues are, you know, how they're feeling about the company. Or you give people freedom to create even if they lose you money. One of the things I found out when I was investing our money in getting into venture capital, I went out to Silicon Valley and talked to a lot of venture funds, and they said, things are different out here. We celebrate failure. I thought, wow, that's interesting. Why is that? They said, well, we would never invest with anybody who hasn't had at least one failure, because we know that they don't know what's going on. They don't even know what the real world is until they've at least had a failure under their belts. And so that's the idea, that you won't feel as though you have freedom to be innovative and creative in a company if you're always afraid of failing. I worked at a bank, and the guy who was in charge of credit for the bank said, I would never want one of my credit officers to have zero losses, because that shows he's not making nearly enough loans. So you want to have some kind of system that allows people to fail so that they can be creative. Well, let's get on to the purposes and uses of financial information, which is, you know, I got a little sidetracked on people, but they are costly. People cost a lot of money, and they're also the most important resource, so you don't want to forget about them, even though you finance people who want to look at the books, you know. Well, two purposes of financial information. One, external accountability. The other, internal control. External accountability is to satisfy the government that you're playing by the rules, and to satisfy investors and lenders as well. We take it for granted, even though we've got all kinds of problems in the United States, and you'll see scandals all, you know, coming up in the news and everything. Would you compare this to some other countries? I mean, our capital markets are unbelievable compared to other places where you have no idea what's going on. I mean, I was scared to death to be invested in these emerging market funds, because you'd ask somebody, well, what's the stock market like there? Well, you know, we just know that country's growing like crazy, and we figure we want to be part of it, but we're not really sure what's going on, or whether they're going to take all our money, or, you know, somebody's just going to take over the stock market. I mean, it's scary. So to have transparency for investors and lenders is something you want to have if you're going to be in the area of finance and working for your company in that. But how about internal control? Well, I'll give you an example that doesn't require you to be in the finance area to see how knowing something about financial information can be extremely important for how you would run your business. When I took over as the CFO of Regent University, I looked at the books, and one thing that really bothered me was we listed tuition. We called gross tuition. That was all the tuition all the students paid. Then we had a line right below that that said, line wasn't right below that. It wasn't on the revenues. It was under expenditures. We had an expenditure line called financial aid. How many people have ever gotten financial aid? Okay, just about everybody. Well, you may not know this, but in many schools, that thing called financial aid, that's not really financial aid. That's a discount. Because there's nobody there standing ready to give the aid. You know, it's not like we had all these donors saying, oh yeah, you know, here's millions of dollars to give out as financial aid. We just reduced our price. That was the financial aid. We said, well, it normally costs whatever, you know, $10,000. For you, 7,000. You get 3,000 in financial aid. Okay. So it showed up as an expenditure. I said, this is ridiculous. You know, this is a discount. We're not getting this full revenue you're showing here. I want to show it as a discount and then show the revenue. Well, as I told you, I didn't know anything about accounting, so our controller said, can't do it. He said, generally accepted accounting principles say, this is the way you do it. I said, fine. You know, when we report it to them, that's the way I report it. Internally, that's not the way we're doing it. We're going to show it as a discount. So we did that. We sent out the reports to the deans of the schools. And they go, oh, what is this? You know, my revenue just went down by 40%. And I said, that's right. You never received that revenue. You didn't have it in the first place. I said, well, what can I do about this? I said, give out less financial aid. Oh, okay. And so our financial aid number, now you may not like this as students, but our financial aid number went from something like 40% to 20%. Because the dean said, ha, I'm just giving away 40%. They didn't even know they were giving away 40% of the revenue. Because it was showing up somewhere as an expenditure that they thought was covered by somebody, some grant, you know, from financial aid. So there's a very simple thing, very simple, that changed behavior tremendously within an organization. And those are the types of things you need to think about. And think about it, I could have said, oh, gee, you know, don't let me get in the way of accounting board standards. But instead, I just said, well, that doesn't make any sense to me, and here's the way I want to do it. You can do that internally. You know what happened? I don't say this to brag about my great prescience or anything, but within 2 years, they changed the accounting standard. It's now reported as a discount. I don't know how it lasted as long as it did, you know, coming out as that expenditure line. But anyway, there's one example of how financial information can have a big effect on behavior in an organization. So other kinds of financial information, budgets. You know, if you keep a budget, that tends to hold you to your budget, and it gives you some kind of control over what's going on internally. Having the people at work for you know what the effect of their actions are on the costs. It's a very simple thing, but a lot of people have no idea what they're doing and what it's costing. They just go and do things, and they don't even know how much this is costing the organization. If you just tell them, they won't do it. You know, they won't waste money if they know that what they're doing is wasting. But if they don't, they don't pay any attention to it. Or effect of your actions on revenues. One of the things a university can do, you know who some of the best recruiters at universities are? Students. Good. Students and faculty. The people who are involved in the actual action of doing the education. Now, it's great to have recruiters. I mean, they're important. But why not have the students and faculty, just by word of mouth and through their normal interactions, be causing an increase in the revenue? But you have to do something. You have to understand what's going on and then deliberately do something to do that. Okay. They asked me to talk about traps. Traps involving money, though. You're working with money in an organization. What can go wrong? Why? How can you get derailed? Well, greed, I'd say, would be number one. And one of the ways you can have greed is by presuming on God. I had a friend who, years ago, he had a business, and he got together with four or five other Christians who had businesses, and they rented out an entire floor of a brand new office building because they wanted to be together, and they thought they could share the secretarial costs and office costs and conference room and things like that. Well, that was all great. But as soon as they got in there, the other Christian business owners got together, and they said, you know, the things we're doing, we're just not making enough money. I think God's going to show us some amazing ideas for 30-fold, 100-fold. You know, and they had these ideas where they were going to become millionaires. And my friend said, well, I understand my business, and it's making money, but I have no idea what you're talking about. And I'm really worried about it, you know, getting into that. Well, they said, you don't have any faith, you know, let's do it. So they got into it. They all lost all their money, went bankrupt, and then they just all moved out and left him in this whole big floor office building all by himself with millions of dollars of leases and things due. And they didn't pay anything. They just left. And he spent the next 5 years paying off what they left behind because he didn't want to just walk away. So don't just presume on God that just because you're a Christian and you have faith that he ought to just give you something that's going to earn 100-fold. You know, you need to also do something you know something about or work hard or at least know you're hearing from God. Secondly, there's a tendency to favor yourself in financial decisions. That's the greed component. This can happen if you've ever been in a large organization where there's a raise pool. Sometimes they do it this way. They say, okay, you've got six people in your group. You've got this much raise pool, divide it up. The worst thing is if they put you in with it. You know, you're the manager, and they say, okay, it's you plus these other five. Here's how much you get to divide up. Go ahead. So now your part is going against all these other people you're working with. That's a bad idea. But if you own the company, you've got that going all the time. Or if you're the CEO and you have the ability to do that. Recently, somebody told me that the CEO of Delta just took a big bonus. Delta's going down the tubes. And here's the CEO taking a big bonus because he can do it. I mean, to me, that's greed. In fact, many of the big, splashy headlines of corporate greed were CEOs just thinking they deserved it. You know, taking all kinds of perks that they really didn't deserve. But nobody stood up and said, you don't deserve that. Second one is pride. And that is thinking that you did it yourself. It's amazing to me when you talk to people who have had success in business how often they just automatically assume that it was their great ability that caused the success. You see that it's not the case when you see them try it again and fail and again and fail and again and fail. And then after a while they may think, maybe I wasn't so smart after all. I was just in the right place at the right time with that first one. Now my roommate in college, even though he's not a believer, he understood that. When he went to start a company, he was about to start a company, and he said, I know this business. I think I can build this company to 20 million in sales. But somebody else invited him to be the CEO of this other company. Well, the other company, turned out, was in an industry that was growing tremendously. And that company grew to be a $1 billion company in about 10 years. So I had him come and speak to the business school, and I said, tell me, you know, how do you attribute the growth of this company and how much did you cause? And he said, well, I think my part was to grow it 20 million. I knew I could grow a 20 million company. The rest, I was just in the right place at the right time, in the right market. He had an understanding of his own ability and had some humility. Well, in Deuteronomy chapter 8, it talks about God says to Israel, I'm going to bless you. You know, if you follow my commands, I'm going to give you all kinds of blessings. You're going to have huge herds and crops and all of these things. But then God says, you know what? As soon as you get all that, you're going to turn around and say, we did it ourselves. And we don't care about you anymore. But he says, let me tell you something. I'm the one who gives you the ability to create wealth. You don't have it in and of yourself. I'm the one who gives it to you. And so don't just think you did it all yourself. And that's a trap. It's such an enticing trap, though. Because everybody wants to feel good about themselves. So when something good happens, they think they did it. I mean, and you do. You get some credit, but just don't take all the credit. Third one is lack of discipline. And here I'm talking about laziness when it comes to sin. Because there are all kinds of temptations in an organization, in a corporation. And just little things. Could be expense reports. You know, just fudging something. Or, you know, something, oh, well, I kind of, you know, I didn't exactly do that, but I might have done it, so they put it down there. And so, just little things that everybody's doing, and you kind of do it for a while, and pretty soon, it just seems okay. Then you do something else, like self-dealing to your own company. Let's say you're in charge of letting a contract, and you start a company, or you already have one on the side, and you just deal with your own company. Well, hey, I've got the best company around, so I'm doing a good thing for my other company that I hired from. That's not good, though. You know, it's not good to go hiring your own company. There's just too many conflicts of interest there. And so you do something like that. That happened at Enron, by the way. They're just these things that can just kind of build up and up over time until you can have massive, massive fraud within a company. And what you know what will happen to that company? It'll just collapse. And it is just amazing to me how fast. You may think you've got a huge company with all kinds of financial strength. It can be gone tomorrow. You saw that with companies like Enron, WorldCom. Companies that had multi-billion dollar market caps. How can they be gone so fast? Well, part of the reason is that in nowadays, most of the value of a company is what people think it's going to do in the future. So it's all built on expectations. There isn't really anything there, you know, in terms of assets that you could actually sell that are worth anywhere near what that company is valued. And so all you have to do is just change that expectation, which can happen in a second, and all that value can disappear. And that's what happens when, over time, people have had no sensitivity to sin, and sin has crept in, and it's just built and built and built until someone out on the outside realizes it, and boom, their value's gone. Fear is another trap. If you work for a boss who's a real tyrant, he can just sort of cow you into saying what he wants you to say. So when it's time to report your results and they're not what the boss wanted, what do? You say, sorry, boss, we didn't make the goal this month. You know, we're here and we should have been, you know, we wanted to be here. Or do you say, and you just kind of make it sound like you made the goal? Well, you don't want to do that. First of all, because it's dishonest, but secondly, it'll get you in trouble in the long run. But so many people do that out of fear. Even the CEOs of the companies are doing it when they're reporting to Wall Street. Why do they do that? Well, partly they're afraid their company value is going to go down in terms of expectations. But partly they're just afraid of saying they're not doing their job or they're not successful. What should we fear? You know, what are we fearing? We're fearing that the boss might say, you're no good, you're fired. But do we really trust in God? You know, that God has us in the palm of his hand. Maybe we do get fired. But you know what? That might be the best thing that could have happened if you'd worked at one of these companies that went under. Maybe if you said, I'm not going to misreport, and you got fired, you might end up at a good company, and everybody else is out. In fact, you might even have gotten to cash in your stock options or something when the stock was worth something. So, don't fear. Finally, lack of accountability. Nobody likes being accountable. But if you're in a place where there's no accountability, look out. I mean, that is where things are going to go haywire. And we see that in corporate America, where CEOs and chairmen bring on their friends onto a board, and the friends don't want to make them feel bad, and so they don't hold them accountable, and there's no accountability at the top. And then it can work down through an organization where nobody likes dealing with conflict and issues, and so they just kind of let it slide, and there's not accountability. But where there's not accountability, things are just going wrong left and right. Nobody's really looking and digging in. And that's where you can have huge problems. And that's why a lot of these big companies went down the tubes, because they weren't accountable as they were going along. Nobody took corrective action because there was no accountability. And eventually, there's going to be accountability, though. You can't avoid accountability forever. And so it's better to have it when the time comes rather than wait. Because here I said, power corrupts, and it's true. In 1 Samuel, Samuel's talking to God and saying, you know, the people of Israel, they don't like me. They want to have a king. And God says, it's not you, it's me. But we'll give them a king. But let me tell you what's going to happen when you get a king. The king's going to take your children. He's going to take your maidservants, manservants, flocks, crops. He's going to turn you into slaves. And so that's what happens when you have power and no accountability. It's not a good system. And so you need to stay accountable. In fact, let me just give you a couple of bottom line for success. First of all, is to get your value from God, not man. One of the problems that happens with that fear is you're fearing that you're not going to have value, because when you tell them you didn't make your numbers, they're going to say you're no good, and you're going to say, oh, I have no value, I'm no good. But if you know that your value is coming from God, you're not going to be totally disintegrate when somebody tells you you did a lousy job, because you know that you're valuable. Consider others better than yourself. Remember, under greed, I said people think they deserve it. It's unbelievable how often this happens. But if you don't consider yourself to be on the top and the best and the one who ought to get everything first, but consider others before yourself, you'll be in a great position to be successful. Be accountable to authorities. I already mentioned that. Trusting God for the results. Easy to say, but how many people really do it? You know, I don't just mean this week pray and trust in God that next week results are going to be great, but trust in Him when the results aren't looking great. And finally, give God the glory. Like it said in Deuteronomy, you know, I'm the one who gave you the ability, so when things are going well, how about giving some of the glory to me? Now, these are things you can only say to a Christian, I mean, who would understand them totally. But these types of things are very true. They're true about human nature. If you look at what it takes to get to the top of an organization, it's very counterintuitive. Studies have been done of comparing people who are on a fast track who didn't make it, people who are on a fast track who made it to the top. And the kinds of differences, the key differences, were things like considering others better than yourself. The ones that got derailed, all they were thinking about was themselves and how they could get to the next step. The ones who made it were always thinking about how they could help somebody else. and they kept getting pushed down, up, 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 and up. And they were the ones who didn't go outside the boundaries. They were accountable to authorities. And they tended to be optimists, not whether they were trusting God or not, you know, it's hard to say. And they may not have given God the glory, but they shared the credit. They didn't take all the credit themselves. And so these are principles that God has built in that work. They work among human beings because that's how He's built us, to be like this. And so if we do these things, we'll avoid some of the traps that I mentioned. And you can be successful, not just if you're in the finance function, but you can be successful in any organization, whether it's a nonprofit organization, for-profit organization, and you will be glorifying God. So, thank you. Back to the first slide.
Okay.
All this time, and I didn't even give my center one plug, but this is our website. So if you want to find out something about the Regent Center for Entrepreneurship, just go to that website. And you'll see we're trying to be a resource center for people who are interested in business as missions and entrepreneurship in developing countries. And I'd be glad to take questions.
We've got about 8 minutes for questions, guys, so go ahead and raise your hand. I'll get a microphone to you. We want to make sure we get these all recorded. So raise your guys' hands. If you've got a question, I'll get your microphone in order to see you.
Mr. Mulford, I was just wondering why you've noticed, as we all have, just this growing trend in social entrepreneurship as well as business mission. In the last several years, the Bible does, in fact, teach about business mission and all these other principles.
Very good question, and if you come tonight, you'll hear something about that. But I'll tell you that I think it's a combination of the mission field closing up to traditional missions in many cases and being much more open to business. So business is a much more natural way to do missions. In terms of people being interested in business from a biblical perspective, I think that's just a move of God. Because 20 years ago, I had MBA students who felt guilty about coming to business school. They said, my pastor tells me I'm doing the wrong thing. You know, I've got to be a pastor. I've got to be a missionary. I've got to be this, this, this. And I feel guilty because I want to be a business person. Well, that's not what's happening now. God has done a move, and things are happening in the marketplace, and people are excited about being in business. And so I just attribute that to the move of God. Tremendous opportunity here in the United States, because if you think about it, especially if it's something like something you wanted to do. As I have students who say, I want to start businesses in a foreign country where I don't know anything about the language, the people, and I'm thinking, whoa, you know, this is a hard job. Starting a business is hard in and of itself. Then crossing cultures is hard, which you might be even doing going to an inner city in the U.S. But then to go to another country is even harder. So that's number one. It's easier for the individual, and our system is so much easier to work in. So there are tremendous opportunities within the United States to start a business.
This whole idea of Harvard Business Review, just this December, you know, they had a whole article on corporate social responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of alluded to this earlier that this isn't really a new idea. It's been evolving maybe over the last 20, 30 maybe even years. You reference things like Walmart, be it, you know, internally among their own employee population, out there in society, how it's manifested, how it continues to evolve. Trying to articulate my question. We obviously know from a biblical perspective this is not a new idea. It's, you know, goes back to biblical times, social responsibility. Maybe my question is, with the corporate world seemingly more than ever starting to come to this realization, what might you identify as being the opportunities for Christians to, I don't know if capitalize is the right term, but for lack of a better term, capitalize on this realization.
Mm-hmm.
How can we be even more effective in helping our organizations direct that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I have a great answer to that, because one of the things I noticed over the last 25, 30 years, business ethics became a big issue. And everybody wanted to have a business ethics course. I resisted that at our school because I said every course is a business ethics course. And I didn't want to segregate it off into this one course. What happened was companies were hiring business ethics officers. But they weren't really, even though they might have a title, they might be a vice president, they weren't where the action was. They were shuffled off to the side to just say, hey, we've got a business ethics officer. So I'm worried that social responsibility might be the same type of thing. And so I wouldn't want the Christians at all say, hey, I'm the social responsibility officer, stick me in, and not be where the action is. Because the action is in creating the product and selling the product and making it. You know, that's where the action is. And that's where we ought to be, salt and light in that, not separated out into just trying to define it, you know, this little fringe thing that is sort of vogue for the day. So I'm not sure exactly how that works out, but I'd say, you know, get right into the center of things and be salt and light there.
Hi. I'm working in Indonesia, and as far as you know, like Southeast Asia, the efficiency is not very good. But I'm with like conflict internally, like even though I'm paying like them twice, the efficiency will be the same. And if I'm concerned about them, I'm paying them like over the minimum standard of the marketplace, but the efficiency is the same. Is it okay for me to sack some of them to make like the company to grow? I mean, like, when
for you to do what?
Is it like
to lay them off, fire
yeah,
them?
Yeah, yeah. So make the company.
Well, is it your company?
Yeah.
I mean, you can do whatever you decide to do. I mean, that's your choice. But I don't know that it's necessarily the best idea to just pay people a lot of money if they don't, if they're not doing anything better, and you're not, and they're not noticing that there's some, you know, some reason why you're doing it. Oftentimes, the way you pay people can have an effect. For example, I mentioned my brother's business. He pays probably twice what most of his competitors pay, but he does it oftentimes in a way that, for instance, he might do it with incentives, or he once paid installers by the jobs that they were doing. And what would happen was, these installers might be on a job at 6 o'clock, normally they're going to leave. They'd stay there till 9, 10 o'clock at night. His customers are calling and saying, what's going on here? I've never seen anybody stay and work till 10 o'clock. He said, well, they don't want to have to drive back out there tomorrow, you know, to finish that job, because that's costing them money. So if you can somehow make it fit, you know, that the money they're getting is related to what they're producing for you, then that could be useful.
Thank you for your lecture. Actually, my question is pretty simple. Have you ever experienced biblical way when you're pursuing your business way? I mean, I personally want to listen from your testimony. I mean, when you apply God's word to this field, I received a lot of miracle or blessing, something like that. I mean, if you have some experience.
Well, I'll give you one example. I don't know that it's exactly what you're referring to, but it used to be very difficult for me if I had to lay people off. And at one time, when I became the chief financial officer at the university, it was at a very difficult time financially. That's why they wanted somebody. And so my job was to get finances in order. And that meant laying a lot of people off. So I really prayed about it, trying to figure out, what am I doing here? I came to a place that was growing, and now I'm having to lay people off. But God showed me something that was just amazing. Now, this didn't happen every time, but I would say at least half the people that I laid off, even though they weren't fired for not doing their job, obviously you don't want to lay off the people that are the most productive. So these were people that didn't seem to quite fit. And at least half of them said to me, you know what, thank you for doing this. Because I knew I was in the wrong job, but I was just too stuck in it. You know, I just didn't want to step out and do what God has been calling me to do. But you've kind of nudged me out of the nest by firing me. You know, I was just amazed that that happened in about half the cases. So there's an example where God can use you in a way that you're not expecting. You know, when you're doing something that's financially required, but God is actually moving.
John, can you stick around if people have a further question?
Sure.
Okay, great. So our time is done now, so let's just round the applause for John. Thank you.